Hello, this is John Garnett. I wanted to make a few introductory remarks to the message on the wedding in the spring, that some of the research, to give due respect to some of my sources, was from the Institute in Basic Youth Conflicts seminars and their sections on the wedding ceremony by Mr. Bill Gothard. I wanted to give him full credit for some of the research that I did. Thank you.
Well, good afternoon, brethren. It's good to see so many of you here today. We have quite a few guests. I want to say to Dr. Hoover and the men, that is I remember that song, wow, 30, 40 years ago. It was a beautiful rendition. It's I think Passover weekend this year has special meaning for us, I think, because it is on a Sabbath weekend. Very special indeed. I wanted to clarify in the announcements, Mr. Helge was gracious as always, but the life questions, let me clarify, you need to direct them to Mr. Weber, not to me. So I think he meant that as a joke. I hope he did. Today what I'd like to talk to you about is a very important thing in the church, a very important item, and it has to do with weddings. And I've entitled this Marriage in the Spring. Weddings, we have all been to one, all of us. They're beautiful affairs. Some have been in them. Some have conducted them, a few of us have in this room, and they're very special. They are beautiful affairs. They're always, always lovely, no matter where they are, and people try their best to pick a location that is meaningful to them. By the ocean, in a forest. I even did a marriage a few years ago at the edge, and I mean the edge of the Grand Canyon. And it was absolutely gorgeous. The backdrop of the one of the largest natural wonders of the world is in front of me. It's behind the bride and the groom, and I think we were literally 10 to 15, maybe 20 feet away from the very precipice of this magnificent setting. And so, indeed, it's the setting is really it's full of hope and desire for a lifelong commitment, isn't it? The bride is always in a beautifully, very carefully picked out dress. She's smiling. She's always lovely. It's been said, and it's a truism, there's nothing like, everyone is beautiful as a bride. And she has her maid of honor beside her. The groom, of course, is standing there sweating, panting, praying somehow to get out of this. Has he made the right decision? I have never, ever been to a wedding. Gentlemen, I don't care. I've seen a lot of you. Please don't think anything else. The bride is calm, cool, and collected. The groom ain't. They usually have no idea what's going on. They're not even sure how they got there. And not sure they really want to be there. So picture it, if you will, the aisle, the people, the ushers, the best man, the maid of honor, or matron of honor, the ushers, the flowers, everybody there. The setting, though, is an interesting one, and I'm going to ask you some questions about it. You may have never thought about it before, but there is a reason why in Western culture we have weddings and the ceremonies the way that we do. They're arranged, yes, out of culture, and some out of tradition, to be sure, but its root cause and setting has a very, very interesting prototype and antitype. Let me ask you some of these questions about weddings and marriage as we move ever closer to the Passover. And I'd like you to think about, as we discuss these, the deep connection between a marriage, a wedding, and the Passover. Question number one, you don't need to audibly respond. You can write these down if you wish. There's a few. Why do ushers seat the families and friends of the bride and groom on opposite sides of the auditorium or the church? Is it A, to sit with whom they know? B, to show whom they have support for? C, to symbolize uniting of the families? Or to see who has more friends? Or is it none of the above? Number two, why do ushers enroll a white runner down the center aisle? Is it A, to keep the bride's gown clean? B, to protect the carpet? C, to keep others off the aisle? D, none of the above. Three, Why are the parents of the bride and groom given special seating? 4. Why does the groom enter the auditorium or church before the bride? Why does the father of the bride walk her down the aisle? Is it A, to keep her from falling over? B, to give the bride away? C, to endure public humiliation? Or D, none of the above? Next, what is the real significance of a white wedding dress? Why does the minister ask the question, who gives this woman to be married to this man? Next, why do the bride and groom take each other's right hand during the wedding vows? Next, why does the minister address the bridegroom first in the wedding vows? What is the special meaning of the veil which a bride can wear? Why does the minister say, I now pronounce you husband and wife? What is the purpose of officially introducing the couple to the wedding guests? Why do the couple sign wedding papers? What is the significance of the guest signing the guest book? What is the special purpose of the receiving line? What is the special invitation given to attend the wedding and the reception? What is the significance of food being served at a wedding reception? And why do the couple feed cake to each other during the reception? Is it to show A, they are coordinated? B, to add amusement to the celebration? C, to show their care for each other? Or none of the above? These are all elements of almost all weddings and subsequent marriages, aren't they? We've seen them countless times. The church here has prepared over and over again. If the wedding wasn't here, the reception often is here. And marriage and weddings are a part of our church. It says where God had ordained it. So number one, why do ushers seat the families and friends of the bride and groom on opposite sides of the auditorium? Is it because they just plain don't get along and they never will? No. They seat the family and friends of the bride and groom on opposite sides because it provides a covenant setting. It provides a special arrangement because marriage is established by God as a covenant. He says she is the partner, the wife of your marriage covenant. If you'll turn with me to the book of Malachi, chapter 2 and verse 10. Malachi was a prophet of Israel. He was not kind to Israel and Judah. He speaks of treachery as infidelity. And we see throughout the Bible that God uses over and over again the issues relating to marriage and married life. He says in verse 10 of Malachi chapter 2, have we not all one Father? Has not one God created us? Why do we deal treacherously with one another by profaning the covenant of the fathers? Judah has dealt treacherously, and an abomination has been committed in Israel and in Jerusalem, for Judah has profaned the Eternal's holy institution which he loves. He has married the daughter of a foreign god. May the Eternal cut off from the tents of Jacob the man who does this thing, awake and aware, yet who brings an offering to the Eternal of hosts. And this is the second thing you do. You cover the altar of the Eternal with tears, with weeping and crying. So does he not regard the offering anymore, nor receive it with goodwill from your hands? Yet you say, for what reason? Because the Eternal has been witness between you and the wife of your youth, with whom you have dealt treacherously. She is your companion and your wife by covenant. Marriage is a covenant. What is a covenant? A covenant comes from the Hebrew word that we may know very well being in the church, from berith. It is in the sense of a cutting, a compact made by the passing between pieces of flesh. Turn with me, if you would, to Genesis chapter 15, where we have probably the best description, written description, of the idea of a covenant. And this is Abraham's covenant with God. So we'll take Genesis 15, verse 10. And if any of you have often heard when I speak, I usually like to stick in one chapter and just analyze it and just pull everything, mine it for all that it has. This subject does not lend itself to that. And so I'm going to use a plethora of scriptures, which I'm not wont usually to do. So in Genesis chapter 15 and verse 10, this is talking about Abraham and God. Then he brought all these to him, God, and cut them in two down the middle, many of the goats and heifers and rams and turtle doves and pigeons. He cut them down the middle and placed each opposite the other, but did not cut the birds in two. And when the vultures came down on the carcasses, Abram drove them away. And when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell on Abram, and behold, horror and great darkness fell upon him. Then he said to Abram, "Know certainly that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, and will serve them. And they will afflict them 400 years, and also the nation whom they serve I will judge. Afterward they shall come out with great possessions. Now as for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried at a good old age. But in the fourth generation they shall return here, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet come." And it came to pass, when the sun went down as it was dark, that behold, there appeared a smoking oven and a burning torch that passed between those pieces. On that same day, the Eternal made a covenant with Abraham. And this is the idea of a covenant, an agreement, and in this case with Abraham and with God. So marriage is a covenant. It is a binding agreement. The next question, why do ushers enroll a white runner down this center aisle? The answer is, it is a symbol of walking on holy ground. The ground that the bride walks upon is very special. We don't use a red runner or a black runner or a gray runner, if a runner is used at all. In every wedding I've ever seen, every wedding I've seen on TV, every wedding I've heard about, there is a white runner. The reason is simple. It is a symbol of walking on holy ground. A covenant is not made merely between two people and their witnesses. It is made in the presence of God. If you remember, one of the very first instructions that God ever gave to Moses, just prior to the Exodus and Passover, one of his first instructions to Moses as he approached the burning bush was to take off your shoes. The ground upon which you stand is holy ground. So when we have a wedding or a marriage, it is in the presence of God. He is there. So that's what that runner is there for. It's to symbolize that the covenant of marriage, the wedding, is in God's presence. He is involved. Next question, why are the parents of the bride and groom given special seating? I thought one of the good answers was for the bride anyway, they help pay for it. But the answer is, the parents of the bride and groom are part of the marriage covenant. They are intimately involved. Their commitments that they make during that ceremony is just as binding as the vows of the couple. It is important because it is about a transference of responsibility and authority, because the final responsibility of parents for their sons and daughters is to determine with them God's will for them throughout their life. Thereafter, especially after marriage, they serve in a chain of counsel, of advisement for their children. Thus, parents enter into the marriage covenant in the line of authority and responsibility, and they leave in the line of counsel. It says in Proverbs chapter 23, verse 22, it says to all who would listen, "Listen to your father who gave you life, and do not despise your mother when she is old." We say that to our children when they are little. We say that to our children when they are older. Unfortunately or fortunately for the child, the responsibility of the parents is lifelong. But there is a transference of authority when the child is married. It is different. The authority and the responsibility, they change. Next question. Why does the groom enter the auditorium before the bride? Now, this is a very important question. It's critical to the understanding of the wedding ceremony, the marriage, and its biblical counterparts. The answer, by entering first, the groom signifies that he is the covenant initiator. He is the initiator who assumes greater responsibility in its being carried out successfully. Gentlemen, it's your responsibility. And really, for its authority, no one else. You are the initiator of this covenant relationship. We see also in the spiritual realm, God and Christ initiated all the covenants. They initiated them with Noah and Abraham that we read, and David. Christ initiates the covenant of salvation with us. He is the groom. He is therefore the covenant initiator, and that is why the groom enters the auditorium or the church before the bride. It's almost as if in a physical setting, it's being said to the groom before the bride arrives, as you come before all these witnesses in this setting, are you signifying that you are indeed taking this woman and the initiative in this marriage covenant, and that you will, by the example of our example, Jesus Christ, that you will assume the greater responsibility in carrying out its terms? Because there are terms, as we shall see. Next question. Why does the father of the bride walk her down the aisle? It's a twofold purpose here. Number one, it publicly proclaims the father is involved in this marriage and that he cares about his daughter. In many marriages or weddings, we know that the father is not present for a number of reasons, and so possibly someone stands in for them. But the symbolic point is the same. Number two, the father presents his daughter, from whom he has responsible, passing protection to the husband. It is no longer the protective right of the father, not in the greater scheme, but it is now the husband's. When we do counseling for marriage, it is our practice, and because it is the day in which we live, we often have marriages where someone is not in the church, not yet anyway. That's always a goal. And I tell them that at the beginning of the counseling. And if they counsel with me, we will talk about them possibly understanding fully what the bride or the groom understands. And we would love them to accept that truth and be baptized in the church. But when we have a groom who is not in the church and the girl is, we explain to them that you are marrying one of the daughters of the church. And therefore the church, its people, and its elders will hold you accountable because of that fact. So that is why the father of the bride walks the bride down the aisle. It is one of a transference of protection and of responsibility. The father is responsible for the purity of the daughter before marriage. Think not. Let's go to the law. Deuteronomy chapter 22. If you'll turn there with me, please. Now, this may be painful for many of the young ladies in the church, but I know that I speak for many of the fathers. In fact, I polled a number of you, and I'll tell you what the poll results were when we read this. In Deuteronomy chapter 22, we'll begin in verse 13, if I can see it. It says, if a man takes a wife and goes into her, and he detests her, and charges her with shameful conduct, and brings her a bad name, and says, I took this woman, and when I came to her, I found she was not a virgin. Then the father and mother, look who is called. There's no ages mentioned here, none whatsoever. But think of the principle. Think of the concept here. It says, then the father and mother of the young, they shall call the father and the mother of the young woman, shall take and bring out the evidence of the young woman's virginity to the elders of the city of the gate. And the young woman's father shall say to the elders, notice who speaks. Notice who speaks in the defense of his daughter. And the young woman's father shall say to the elders, I gave my daughter to this man as wife, and he detests her. Now he has charged her with shameful conduct, saying, I found your daughter was not a virgin. And yet these are the evidences of my daughter's virginity. And they shall spread the cloth before the elders of the city. Then the elders of that city shall take that man and punish him. And they shall fine him with 100 shekels of silver and give them to the father of the young woman, because he has brought a bad name on a virgin, daughter of Israel. And she shall be his wife. He cannot divorce her all his days. It was the responsibility of the mother and father to protect their child until transference of authority came to the husband. Now, in this situation, I'm not sure I'd want my daughter married to this moron. But the point and the principle is the same. It is in the law. 2 Corinthians chapter 11 says, listen to your father who gave you life, and do not despise your mother when she is old. It's applicable here as well. 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 38 says, so when he who gives his virgin in marriage, he does a good thing. It is the responsibility, gentlemen, if you have a daughter, to protect your daughter, to look out for your daughter. Next question. What is the real significance of the white wedding dress? Well, we think we know, don't we? The significance is somewhat obvious and not so obvious. The wedding gown symbolizes the purity of heart and life for which the husband is responsible in the life of his wife. Threw a curve at you, didn't I? If the husband is responsible for his wife and the covenant of marriage, he is also therefore responsible for her protection. If he's responsible for her protection, well, let's turn to Ephesians chapter 5, if you would. Ephesians chapter 5 is very clear. Ephesians chapter 5 will begin in verse 25. Husbands, love your wives. And look what he uses, Paul does to the church at Ephesus as the analogy. Just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her, that he might sanctify and cleanse her with the washing of water by the word, that he might present her to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she should be holy and without blemish. Verse 28. So husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. Verse 29, for no one, let's put it bluntly, I'll retranslate a little bit, for no man ever hated himself. Right, ladies? We love ourselves. And therefore, Paul says in the book of Ephesus, to the book of Ephesus, he says, love them as you would yourself. He says to take care of the bride. The answer is important that we understand that just as in marriage, that the husband is to watch out for his wife, Christ looks out for the church. Christ looks out that he may present the bride chaste and holy. We'll talk about how he does that. We'll talk about because it's important. Let's go to the next question. Why does the minister ask the question, who gives this woman to be married to this man? Again, the answer is, the father's responsibility. It shows the acknowledgments of a transference of protection and responsibility. It symbolizes not only the full blessing of a parent in the physical sense in this transfer of responsibility, but as we read in Numbers, a father is responsible. So it is a father who transfers it. We might ask the fathers during the wedding ceremony, are you hereby transferring your God-given responsibility for the care and protection of your daughter to this man? And expect a response from the father. Expect a response. Next question. Why does the bride and groom take each other's right hand during the wedding vows? Now, this is important for an interesting reason. Historically, the open right hand symbolized strength, honor, honesty, and purpose. It was a pledge. Give me your right hand. Now, as I've said before, I being left-handed with, how many of you are left-handed? All those hands, we don't feel highly offended, but we feel there is a little bit of well, whatever. God uses his right hand often as a symbol of strength. It is that he led Israel out with what? His right hand, a strong and high right hand. He delivered Israel from Egypt. The right hand is significant. I'll refer to Genesis chapter 2, 24 for you in Psalm 26. The handshake is an important point of an agreement and a covenant. Let a man's word be his bond. Let's settle it on what? A handshake. If someone were to hand you their left hand in an agreement, you'd think twice about shaking their hand, wouldn't you? So the right hands are important. In the marriage ceremony that we have in the church, which is all contained in our little black book here, it does say, as a very important point of order, is that they take their right hands one with another. Because it's a pledge of commitment. A right hand is important, and that's why it's done in a marriage ceremony, in a wedding. It is important. So this handshake of the right hand, it symbolizes the cleaving together of two lives as one. Two becoming one. The clasping of the right hands. Next question. Why does the minister address the bridegroom first in the wedding vows? Well, now you should pretty well understand the answer to this. The groom makes the vows first because the groom is indeed the initiator, isn't he? He makes his commitment first, and he must assume the greater responsibility to fulfill the marriage covenant. I want you to think about and remember this fact about the groom speaking first when we get to the end of this message and some of the verses I'll reference. It is his responsibility. What is the special meaning of the veil which the bride wears? The veil represents modesty and respect. It symbolizes the sanctity and the exclusiveness of marriage and its covenant. It reminds the couple that they are devoted or should be devoted only to each other in marriage. There is no third party involved in the marriage covenant, not in the physical relationship. And so it is just these two. They and the witnesses during the wedding ceremony make vows, and they're only to be entered in among the two. The only vows that are made are the promises, the words that are said during a wedding ceremony are really the bride's and the groom's. The minister is just there to make sure that things go along smoothly. That's all he's really there for. There is further significance in the veil as it relates to salvation. When Christ fulfilled the conditions of his covenant for our redemption, the veil in the temple was taken away. But the veil for the bride symbols both modesty and respect. You'll notice, interestingly, in the news and events current in our world, is that France has just passed a very, very interesting law. Right? Have you heard about it? How many of you heard about this new law? And yeah, most of you have. That the symbol of modesty and respect, the burqa, and there's another phrase for another type of burqa, is not permitted in the environs of many parts of France. It is not also permitted in any of the government buildings in London, because that may be a sign of modesty and respect. It's also one they feel of secretive motives. So it's interesting. So it is an old custom about a veil. Next, why does the minister say, "I now pronounce you husband and wife"? The pronouncement of husband and wife establishes a definitive point in time from the beginning of the marriage. And I think we all take it that way, don't we? When we spin them around and they're happy, groom usually looks still scared to death, right? And there's usually no blood in their face. Right? They look delirious, but the bride, she looks great. And the minister pronounces pronounces them husband and wife. It's a definitive point in their marriage. These words remove any doubt about who these people are in front of all those witnesses. And the witnesses are there to testify. I was there. They were pronounced husband and wife. I saw it. So they're witnesses of that fact. The point in time is also important in terms of salvation. When we confess with our mouth that Jesus Christ is Lord and we have been saved from their sins by the power of God and Christ's resurrection pictured in the Passover and the days of unleavened bread, that God did raise him from the dead, we are united with Christ in salvation. It's much like baptism. Public baptism and the authority of God's word gives that authority at a specific point in time that these things occurred. Next question. What is the purpose of the officially introducing the couple of to the wedding guests? Once again, introduction of the new couple before the witnesses establishes a change of names. We also say, "I now pronounce you husband and wife, Mr. and Mrs. John Smith." It's very formal, but they have been given new names, and that's important. Next question. Why do they sign, the couple does, a wedding set of wedding papers? The couple signs wedding papers to establish a public written document. It is continuing public evidence of a covenant. And many, in fact, I've signed a couple that it does say covenant on that ceremony. I've done marriages in, I think, five states, and they're all very, very similar. What I think is interesting, when they sign those papers, that just as we're done with the ceremony, there is this mad furor to have me or the minister sign the paperwork. It's not important that we sign it. Not as a minister. You know what we sign as? Witness of the performing of the ceremony. We're a witness. But they too have to sign. And it's more important that they sign, because they're signing the covenant. I could sign it anything. It doesn't matter. But Mr. and Mrs. Smith need to sign it as Mr. and Mrs. Smith. I could sign it as Mickey Mouse. In fact, three or four of them I have, and they just have never discovered it. I'm kidding. What is the significance of the guest signing the guest book? You should know by now. They are giving their written testimony that they were what? Witnesses to the covenant, that they were there. What is the special purpose of the receiving line? The guests give their blessing to the couple and the parents in a receiving line. When Boaz entered into covenant with Ruth and to be his wife, the people that were in the gate and the elders said, "We are witnesses." And they gave their blessing. And that's important, that witnesses are there for a good reason. They want to be there. There's very few people that go to weddings that don't want to be there. The only people that don't want to be there are usually former girlfriends and former boyfriends, and I'm still trying to figure out why they go. But anyway, they want to make sure that, well, he finally found somebody. So everyone there is a witness. Why is a special invitation given to attend the reception? The invitation for the reception symbolizes the invitation in a spiritual sense to salvation. We call it in the church a calling, a chosen, an election. It is important. God sends out invitations to the wedding. He sends out invitations. He sends out invitations to salvation, and he doesn't to everyone. Next question. What is the significance of food being served at the wedding reception? This is very important. I mean, I expect to be fed after I've given a wedding ceremony. I'm kidding. The meaning of serving food at the reception, it is part of the covenant celebration. The food that is passed among the guests are part of the root meanings of the word covenant is to feed. Following a marriage, a feast is always customary in almost all cultures. They rarely have a feast before like they have one afterwards. In many cultures, the wedding feast can last for days and days and days. Entering into a meal itself is a form of covenant. It is significant that the first event of Christ's ministry was what? A wedding. His first miracle was changing water into wine at a wedding. Weddings and marriages are important. It was that he chose that first miracle to be at a wedding. And he did something that's partaken of at the reception is something to drink. Last question. Why does the couple feed cake to each other during the reception? To a degree, much like the guests at a reception eat food, it is part of the covenant relationship. But when it happens one with another, when one gives food to another, it is a deep act of friendship in most cultures to offer food. And we make light of it in this culture. But if you've ever traveled overseas into Asia or the Middle East, to not offer food to a guest is a disgrace. It is a disgrace, and you've heard messages on that before. It also acts as a symbolically of the two becoming one flesh when they share those things. They feed cake to each other. They feed cake to each other, saying that they will help and nurture the relationship as it goes along. The obvious New Testament confirmation of the symbolism is indeed in Passover, where Christ shares of himself. He uses very common, very everyday table elements, and he transforms the bread and the wine into something completely different that has changed humanity, changed history, and changed us. Simple things of table fellowship. So, brethren, this spring at Passover, we will all assemble in this room together and with each other and as witnesses one to another. I hope all of you come tomorrow night, those of you that are baptized and are compelled to come to this very important evening. We renew our commitment tomorrow night in our waiting for the bridegroom, for the wedding, for the return of Christ. It is an annual reminder of the ceremony that God uses in both testaments, both old and new, of wedding and marriage and of covenant, of the betrothed and the wedding process, because indeed we are betrothed. We are engaged. By biblical custom, to be betrothed and to be engaged is to be effectively what? married. You were married. You saw no one else. The culture of the Western Hemisphere has changed much of that. But in our Bibles that we read, to be betrothed or engaged, you were effectively married. One of the few things that could break off a betrothment, two things, in fact. One was sleeping with someone else, having relations with someone else, and death. And in many cultures, it was the same thing. So to be betrothed and engaged is to be married. We are betrothed to keep ourselves spotless and holy. But as the days of unleavened bread will picture and have pictured every year you observe it, you cannot. You cannot take sin out of your life. You can only attempt to do it with God's Spirit. If we could do it on our own, we wouldn't need God, would we? We are to keep ourselves holy, to exemplify the actions of the beliefs that we have coincide with our lives, that the actions are worthy for Christ's select, his elected, his firstborn, and those that he has granted forgiveness and salvation. And because we have been forgiven, and we brought this up at great length in the Bible study, because we have been forgiven by God and Jesus Christ, we forgive one another completely, completely and unilaterally. We forgive as we have been forgiven. That we focus on our good works that are meet for repentance. Marriage is a holy covenant, both in the physical sense and the spiritual sense. And whereas many of us may not have had the opportunity to marry, and many of us have had or have less than a perfect marriage, my wife's current marriage is not a perfect one. Mine is. But all marriages, be they yet to be, be they current marriages or past marriages, all of these marriages will pale. God tells us over and over again, all that we do in this life will pale into utter insignificance when we do indeed meet God and we have the marriage supper of the Lamb at Christ's return. Hebrew canon tells us that all marriages must be formed with a ketubah, which is a covenant. And I've been in many homes of clients that are Jewish, and there on the wall, very prominently displayed, is the ketubah, the wedding contract. It's quite a lengthy document. It is predicated, this covenant of marriage, it is predicated on who does what, on what the husband's supposed to do and what the wife is supposed to do. It mirrors the book of the law in Deuteronomy. I'd ask you the last few hours that we have before Passover that indeed you might want to read chapters 28 till the end of the book. It's a very easy read. It has to do and is very specific about what God will do in this covenant and what we should do in this covenant. In particular, it's what Israel should do. What Israel would do in Deuteronomy and what God would do. That's the blessings and the cursings that God did promise. If you do these things, I will do these things. He is the initiator. And in Deuteronomy chapter 28, he speaks first. He speaks first because he is the initiator of the covenant. And Israel was to perform certain acts. We are, brethren, the Israel of God. Galatians tells us that. We are a part of the new covenant and the Israel of God. We are Christ's, his betrothed. At the end of the day, God uses marriage as an example. And as marriages can be wonderful, wonderful events of many, many decades, we heard that in the first fine message, it can be many, many decades. He uses a marriage as an analogy, but I believe that God uses the analogies only because we'll understand them. But he gives us only what we can handle. Because as it was said by one man, we couldn't really handle the truth. Because I think the truth is so much greater. We have finite minds, even with God's Spirit. We have finite minds. And God indeed is going to give us so much more. But because we are betrothed to Christ, we should act accordingly. We should read every day from what God has written for us. We should pray every day to God about what we should do, could do, and what we shouldn't have done, and what we can do. We do this every day. It is a daily event in the life of someone who has been elected and chosen for a specific task. And when it has to do with eventually coming into God's kingdom, we observe his commands. And again, one of his commands, especially during the Passover season, is that we forgive one another, that we look out for one another, we take care of one another, we treat others as we wish we would like to be treated. When we meet tomorrow, we will memorialize an event that has a history going back of 3,500 years. I'm always struck by that every Passover. When we sit down, we are a part of a chain of events and of history, starting with the Passover in Egypt, which leads eventually to Christ's sacrifice and on into the wedding supper and God's return. It's all a process, and tomorrow night is a part of that process. It's an annual event. We renew ourselves to a set of beliefs and actions that are worthy of that marriage and that union. God wishes to be with his people, and his Son is the bridge. When we come tomorrow evening, we come as sinful, broken people. Yet now we are forgiven and healed. I don't know how many Passovers I've had. I think it's not quite 40, but it's getting close. I have yet, in seeing thousands and thousands of people, I have yet to see a perfect human being walk into the room. Forgiven, yes. But we come as formerly fragmented people, now committed people. People who realize they have been given part of God's Spirit. As we were, who would want to be with us? As we were before, and only you know who you were before and who you are now, who would want to be with us? Who would, after what we have done, who would want to be a part of us? Who would ever accept us? Who would ever want to live forever with us? Tomorrow night, we come together to remember that God does.